smile and nodded encouragingly. "That's it exactly. All your inhibitions have been sliced off so cleanly you can't even tell they're gone. But everything else is the same. You're steady, articulate, and rational."
"You're patronizing me," I said, pointing at him with the knife.
"Don't." He blinked.
"Fair enough. Can you think of a solution to the problem?"
"Of course. I need some sort of behavioral touchstone. You're going to need to be my compass because you still have your filters in place."
"I was thinking the same thing," he said. "So you'll trust me?"
I nodded. "Except when it comes to women. You're an idiot with women." I picked up a glass of water from a nearby table and rinsed my mouth out with it, spitting it onto the floor. Sim gave a shaky smile.
"Fair enough. First, you can't go kill Ambrose."
I hesitated.
"You're sure?"
"I'm sure. In fact, pretty much anything you think to do with that knife is going to be a bad idea. You should give it to me."
I shrugged and flipped it over in my palm, handing him the makeshift leather grip.
Sim seemed surprised by this, but he took hold of the knife.
"Merciful Talo,"
he said with a profound sigh, setting the knife down on the bed.
"Thank you."
"Was that an extreme case?" I asked, rinsing my mouth out again. "We should probably have some sort of ranking system, like a 10-point scale."
"Spitting water onto my floor is a 1, he said.
"Oh," I said.
"Sorry."
I put the cup back onto his desk.
"It's okay," he said easily. "Is 1 low or high?" I asked.
"Low," he said. "Killing Ambrose is a 10.
He hesitated.
"Maybe an 8.
He shifted in his seat.
"Or a 7.
"Really?"
I said. "That much?"
"Okay, then."
I leaned forward in my seat.
"You need to give me some tips for admissions. I've got to get back into line before too long."
Simmons shook his head firmly. "No, that's a really bad idea. 8.
"Really?"
"Really," he said. "It's a delicate social situation. A lot of things could go wrong. But if..."
Sim let out a sigh, brushing his sandy hair out of his eyes.
"Am I your touchstone or not? This is going to get tedious if I have to tell you everything 3 times before you listen."
I thought about it for a moment.
"You're right. Especially if I'm about to do something potentially dangerous."
I looked around.
"How long is this going to last?"
"No more than 8 hours.
He opened his mouth to continue, then closed it.
"What?"
I asked.
Sim sighed.
"There might be some side effects. It's lipid-soluble, so it will hang around in your body a bit. You might experience occasional minor relapses brought about by stress, intense emotion, exercise." He gave me an apologetic look. "They'd be like little echoes of this."
"I'll worry about that later," I said. I held out my hand.
"Give me your admissions tile. You can go through now. I'll take your slot."
He spread his hands helplessly.
"I've already gone," he explained.
"Talu's tits and teeth," I cursed.
"Fine. Go get Fella." He waved his hands violently in front of himself.
"No, no, 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 10.
I laughed.
"Not for that. She has a slot late on Kendling."
"You think she'll trade with you? She's already offered."
Sim got to his feet.
"I'll go find her."
"I'll stay here," I said.
Sim gave an enthusiastic nod and looked nervously around the room.
"It's probably safest if you don't do anything while I'm gone," he said as he opened the door.
"Just sit on your hands until I get back."
Sim was only gone for 5 minutes, which was probably for the best. There was a knock on the door.
"It's me,"
Sim's voice came through the wood. "Is everything all right in there?"
"You know what's strange?" I said to him through the door. "I tried to think of something funny I could do while you were gone, but I couldn't."
I looked around at the room.
"I think that means humor is rooted in social transgression.
I can't transgress because I can't figure out what would be sociably unacceptable. Everything seems the same to me.
You might have a point, he said, then asked. Did you do something anyway?
No, I said. I decided to be good.
Did you find Fella?
I did. She's here, but before we come in, you have to promise not to do anything without asking me first. Fair?
I laughed. Fair enough. Just don't make me do stupid things in front of her.
I promise, Sim said.
Why don't you sit down, just to be safe?
I'm already sitting, I said.
Sim opened the door. I could see Fella peering over his shoulder.
Hello, Fella, I said. I need to trade slots with you.
First, Sim said, you should put your shirt back on. That's about a 2.
Oh, I said. Sorry, I was hot.
You could have opened the window.
I thought it would be safer if I limited my interactions with external objects, I said.
Sim raised an eyebrow.
That's actually a really good idea. It just steered you a little wrong in this case.
Wow, I heard Fella's voice from the hallway. Is he serious?
Absolutely serious, Sim said. Honestly, I don't think it's safe for you to come in.
I tugged my shirt on. Dressed, I said. I'll even sit on my hands if it will make you feel better.
I did just that, tucking them under my legs.
Sim let Fella inside, then closed the door behind her.
Fella, you are just gorgeous, I said. I would give you all the money in my purse if I could just look at you naked for 2 minutes. I'd give everything I own, except my loot.
It's hard to say which of them blushed a deeper red. I think it was Sim.
I wasn't supposed to say that, was I? I said.
No, Sim said. That's about a 5.
But that doesn't make any sense, I said. Women are naked in paintings. People buy paintings, don't they? Women pose for them.
Sim nodded. That's true, but still, just sit for a moment and don't say or do anything, okay?
I nodded.
I can't quite believe this, Fella said, the blush fading from her cheeks. I can't help but think the two of you are playing some sort of elaborate joke on me.
I wish we were, Simmons said. This stuff is terribly dangerous.
How can he remember naked paintings and not remember you're supposed to keep your shirt on in public?
She asked Sim, her eyes never leaving me.
It just didn't seem very important, I said. I took my shirt off when I was whipped. That was public. It seems a strange thing to get in trouble for.
Do you know what would happen if you tried to knife Ambrose? Simon asked.
I thought for a second.
It was like trying to remember what you'd eaten for breakfast a month ago.
There'd be a trial, I suppose, I said slowly.
And people would buy me drinks.
Fella muffled a laugh behind her hand.
How about this?
Simon asked me.
Which is worse, stealing a pie or killing Ambrose?
I gave it a moment's hard thought.
A meat pie or a fruit pie?
Wow, Fella said breathlessly. That's...
She shook her head.
It almost makes my skin crawl.
Simon nodded.
It's a terrifying piece of alchemy. It's a variation of a sedative called a plumbob. You don't even have to ingest it. It's absorbed straight through the skin.
Fella looked at him.
How do you know so much about it?
Sim gave a weak smile.
Mandrag lectures about it in every alchemy class he teaches. I've heard the story a dozen times by now. It's his favorite example of how alchemy can be abused. An alchemist used it to ruin the lives of several government officials in Aetur about 50 years ago. He only got caught because a countess ran amok in the middle of a wedding, killed a dozen folk and...
Sim stopped, shaking his head.
Anyway, it was bad. Bad enough that the alchemist's mistress turned him over to the guards.
I hope he got what he deserved.
And with some to spare, Sim said grimly. The point is, it hits everyone a little differently. It's not a simple lowering of inhibition. There is an amplification of emotion, a freeing up of hidden desire combined with a strange type of selective memory, almost like a moral amnesia.
I don't feel bad, I said. I feel pretty good, actually, but I'm worried about admissions.
Sim gestured. See? He remembers admissions. It's important to him, but other things are just... gone.
Is there a cure? Fella asked nervously. Shouldn't we take him to the Medica?
Simon looked nervous.
I don't think so. They might try a purgative, but it's not as if there's a drug working through him. Alchemy doesn't work like that. He's under the influence of unbound principles. You can't flush those out the way you'd try to get rid of mercury or Ophalum.
A purgative doesn't sound like much fun, I added. If my vote counts for anything.
And there's a chance they might think he's cracked under admission stress, Sim said to Fella. That happens to a few students every term. They'd stick him in Haven until they were sure.
I was on my feet, my hands clenched into fists. I'll be cut to pieces in hell before I let them stick me in Haven, I said, furious. Even for an hour, even for a minute.
Sim blanched and took a step back, raising his hands defensively, palms out. But his voice was firm and calm.
Quoth, I'm telling you three times, stop.
I stopped. Fella was watching me with wide, frightened eyes.
Simon continued firmly.
Quoth, I'm telling you three times, sit down. I sat.
Standing behind him, Fella looked at Simon, surprised.
Thank you, Simon said graciously, lowering his hands. I agree. The Medica isn't the best place for you. We can just ride this out here.
That sounds better to me, too, I said.
Even if things did go smoothly at the Medica, Simon added, I expect you will be more inclined to speak your mind than usual. He gave a small, wry smile. Secrets are the cornerstone of civilization, and I know you have a few more than most folk.
I don't think I have any secrets, I said.
Sim and Fella both burst out laughing at the same time.
I'm afraid you just proved his point, Fella said.
I know you have at least a few.
So do I, Sim said.
You're my touchstone, I shrugged. Then I smiled at Fella and pulled out my purse.
Sim shook his head at me. No, 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 I've already told you. Seeing her naked would be the worst thing in the world right now.
Fella's eyes narrowed a little at that.
What's the matter? I asked.
Are you worried I'll tackle her to the ground and ravage her?
I laughed.
Sim looked at me.
Wouldn't you?
Of course not, I said.
He looked at Fella, then back.
Can you say why? He asked curiously.
I thought about it.
It's because...
I trailed off, then shook my head.
I just can't. I know I can't eat a stone or walk through a wall. It's like that.
I concentrated on it for a second and began to get dizzy. I put one hand over my eyes and tried to ignore the sudden vertigo.
Please tell me I'm right about that, I asked, suddenly scared. I can't eat a stone, can I?
You're right, Fella said quickly. You can't.
I stopped trying to rummage around the inside of my mind for answers, and the odd vertigo faded. Sim was watching me intently.
I wish I knew what that signified, he said.
I have a fair idea, Fella murmured softly.
I drew the ivory admissions tile out of my purse.
I was just looking to trade, I said.
Unless you're willing to let me see you naked. I hefted the purse with my other hand and met Fella's eye.
Sim says it's wrong, but he's an idiot with women. My head might not be screwed on quite as tightly as I'd like, but I remember that clearly.
It was 4 hours before my inhibitions began to filter back, and 2 more before they were firmly in place. Simmons spent the entire day with me, patient as a priest, explaining that no, I shouldn't go buy us a bottle of brand. No, I shouldn't go kick the dog that was barking across the street. No, I shouldn't go to Imre and look for Denna. No. 3 times no. By the time the sun went down, I was back to my regular, semi-moral self,
Simon quizzed me extensively before walking me back to my room at Anchor's, where he made me swear on my mother's milk that I wouldn't leave my room until morning. I swore. But all was not right with me. My emotions were still running hot, flaring up at every little thing. Worse, my memory hadn't simply returned to normal. It was back with a vivid and uncontrollable enthusiasm. It hadn't been that bad when I was with Simon. His presence was a pleasant distraction. But alone in my small garret room in Anchor's, I was at the mercy of my memory. It was as if my mind was determined to unpack and examine every sharp and painful thing I had ever seen. You might think the worst memories were those of when my troop was killed, of how I came back to our camp and found everything aflame, the unnatural shapes my parents' bodies made in the dim twilight, the smell of scorched canvas and blood and burning hair, memories of the ones who killed them, of the Chandrian, of the man who spoke to me, grinning all the while, of Cinder. These were bad memories, but over the years I had brought them out and handled them so often there was hardly a sharp edge left to them. I remembered the pitch and timbre of Haliax's voice as clearly as my father's. I could easily bring to mind the face of Cinder, his perfect smiling teeth, his white curling hair, his eyes black as beads of ink, his voice full of winter's chill, saying, "Someone's parents have been singing entirely the wrong sorts of songs." You would think these would be the worst memories, but you would be wrong. No, the worst memories were those of my young life. The slow roll and bump of riding in the wagon, my father holding the reins loosely, his strong hands on my shoulders, showing me how to stand on the stage so my body said proud, or sad, or shy. His fingers adjusting mine on the strings of his lute. My mother brushing my hair. The feel of her arms around me. The perfect way my head fit into the curve of her neck. How I would sit, curled in her lap next to the fire at night, drowsy and happy and safe. These were the worst memories. Precious and perfect, sharp as a mouthful of broken glass. I lay in bed, clenched into a trembling knot, unable to sleep, unable to turn my mind to other things, unable to stop myself from remembering again and again and again. Then there came a small tapping at my window, a sound so tiny I didn't notice it until it stopped. Then I heard the window ease open behind me. "Quoth?" Ari said softly. I clenched my teeth against the sobbing and lay still as I could, hoping she would think I was asleep and leave. "Quoth?" she called again. "I brought you..." There was a moment of silence. Then she said, "Oh." I heard a soft sound behind me. The moonlight showed her tiny shadow on the wall as she climbed through the window. I felt the bed move as she settled onto it. A small, cool hand brushed the side of my face. "It's okay," she said quietly. "Come here." I began to cry quietly, and she gently uncurled the tight knot of me until my head lay in her lap. She murmured, brushing my hair away from my forehead, her hands cool against my hot face. "I know," she said sadly. "It's bad sometimes, isn't it?" She stroked my hair gently, and it only made me cry harder. I could not remember the last time someone had touched me in a loving way. "I know," she said. "You have a stone in your heart, and some days it's so heavy, there's nothing to be done. But you don't have to be alone for it. You should have come to me. I understand." My body clenched, and suddenly the taste of plum filled my mouth again.
"I miss her,"
I said before I realized I was speaking. Then I bit it off before I could say anything else. I clenched my teeth and shook my head furiously like a horse fighting its reins.
"You can say it,"
Ari said gently. I shook again, tasted plum, and suddenly the words were pouring out of me.
She said I sang before I spoke. She said when I was just a baby, she had the habit of humming when she held me. Nothing like a song, just a descending third, just a soothing sound. Then one day she was walking me around the camp and she heard me echo it back to her, two octaves higher, a tiny piping third. She said it was my first song. We sang it back and forth to each other for years.
I choked and clenched my teeth.
You can say it, Ari said softly. It's okay if you say it.
I'm never gonna see her again,
I choked out. Then I began to cry in earnest.
It's okay, Ari said softly. I'm here. You're safe.
Chapter 8. Questions. The next few days were neither pleasant nor productive. Fella's admission slot was at the very end of the span, so I attempted to put the extra time to good use. I tried to do some piecework in the fishery, but quickly returned to my room when I broke down crying halfway through inscribing a heat funnel. Not only couldn't I maintain the proper alarm, but the last thing I needed was for people to think I'd cracked under the stress of admissions. Later that night, when I tried to crawl through the narrow tunnel into the archives, the taste of plum flooded my mouth, and I was filled with a mindless fear of the dark, confining space. Luckily, I'd only gone a dozen feet, but even so, I almost gave myself a concussion struggling backwards out of the tunnel, and my palms were scraped raw from my panicked scrabbling against the stone. So I spent the next 2 days pretending I was sick and keeping to my tiny room. I played my lute, slept fitfully, and thought dark thoughts of Ambrose. Anchor was cleaning up when I came downstairs.
"Feeling better?" he asked.
"A bit," I said. Yesterday, I'd only had 2 plum echoes, and they were very brief. Better yet, I'd managed to sleep the whole night through. It seemed I was through the worst of it.
"You hungry?"
I shook my head. "Admissions today." Anchor frowned.
"You should have something, then. An apple."
He bustled around behind the bar, then brought out a pottery mug and a heavy jug.
"Have some milk, too. I've got to make use of it before it turns. Damn Iceless started giving up the ghost a couple days ago. 3 talents solid that thing cost me. I knew I shouldn't have wasted money on it with ice so cheap around here."
I leaned over the bar and peered at the long wooden box tucked away among the mugs and bottles. "I could take a look at it for you," I offered. Anchor raised an eyebrow.
"Can you do something with it?"
"I can look," I said. "Could be something simple I could fix." Anchor shrugged.
"You can't break it more than it's already broken."
He wiped his hands on his apron and motioned me behind the bar.
"I'll do you a couple eggs while you're having your look. I should use those up, too."
He opened the long box, took out a handful of eggs, then walked back into the kitchen. I made my way around the corner of the bar and knelt to look at the Iceless. It was a stone-lined box the size of a small traveling trunk. Anywhere other than the university, it would have been a miracle of artificing, a luxury. Here, where such things were easy to come by, it was just another piece of needless god-bothering that wasn't working properly. It was about as simple a piece of artificing as could be made. No moving parts at all, just 2 flat bands of tin covered in sigildry that moved heat from one end of the metal band to the other. It was really nothing more than a slow, inefficient heat siphon. I crouched down and rested my fingers on the tin bands. The right-hand one was warm, meaning the half on the inside would be correspondingly cool. But the one on the left was room temperature. I craned my neck to get a look at the sigildry and spotted a deep scratch in the tin, scoring through 2 of the runes. That explained it. A piece of sigildry is like a sentence in a lot of ways. If you remove a couple words, it simply doesn't make any sense. I should say it usually doesn't make sense. Sometimes a damaged piece of sigildry can do something truly unpleasant. I frowned down at the band of tin. This was sloppy artificing. The runes should have been on the inside of the band, where they couldn't be damaged. I rummaged around until I found a disused ice hammer in the back of a drawer, then carefully tapped the two damaged runes flat into the soft surface of the tin. Then, I concentrated and used the tip of a paring knife to etch them back into the thick metal band. Anchor emerged from the kitchen with a plate full of eggs and tomatoes. "It should work now," I said. I started eating out of politeness, then realized I was actually hungry. Anchor looked over the box, lifting the lid.
"That easy?"
"Same as anything else," I said, my mouth half full. "Easy if you know what you're doing. It should work. Give it a day and see if it actually chills down." I finished off the plate full of eggs and drank the milk as quickly as I could without being rude. "I'll need to cash out my bar credit today," I said. "Tuition's going to be hard this term." Anchor nodded and checked a small ledger he kept underneath the bar, tallying all the Graysdale mead I'd pretended to drink over the last 2 months. Then he pulled out his purse and counted out 10 copper jots onto the table, a full talent, twice what I'd expected. I looked up at him, puzzled.
"One of Kilvin's boys would have charged me at least half a talent to come round and fix this thing,"
Anchor explained, kicking at the iceless. "I can't be sure..." He waved me into silence.
"If it isn't fixed, I'll take it out of your wages over the next month," he said. "Or I'll use it as leverage to get you to start playing Reaving Night too."
He grinned.
"I consider it an investment."
I gathered the money into my purse. 4 talents. I was heading toward the fishery to see if my lamps had finally sold when I caught a glimpse of a familiar face crossing the courtyard wearing Dark Master's robes.
"Master Elodin!"
I called as I saw him approaching a side door to the Master's Hall. It was one of the few buildings I hadn't spent much time in, as it contained little more than living quarters for the Masters, the resident Gillers, and guest rooms for visiting Arcanists. He turned at the sound of his name, then, seeing me jogging toward him, he rolled his eyes and turned back to the door.
"Master Elodin," I said, breathing a little hard, "might I ask you a quick question?"
"Statistically speaking, it's pretty likely," he said, unlocking the door with a bright brass key.
"May I ask you a question, then?"
"I doubt any power known to man could stop you." He swung open the door and headed inside. I hadn't been invited, but I slipped inside after him. Elodin was difficult to track down, and I worried if I didn't take this chance, I might not see him again for another span of days. I followed him through a narrow stone hallway. "I heard a rumor you were gathering a group of students to study naming," I said cautiously.
"That's not a question," Elodin said as he headed up a long, narrow flight of stairs.
I fought back the urge to snap at him and took a deep breath instead.
"Is it true you're teaching such a class?"
"Yes."
"Were you planning on including me?"
Elodin stopped and turned to face me on the stairway. He looked out of place in his Dark Master's robe. His hair was tousled, and his face was too young, almost boyish. He stared at me for a long minute. He looked me up and down as if I were a horse he were thinking of betting on, or a side of beef he was considering selling by the pound. But that was nothing compared to when he met my eyes. For a heartbeat, it was simply unsettling. Then, it almost felt like the light on the stairway grew dim, or that I was suddenly being thrust deep underwater, and the pressure was keeping me from drawing a full breath.
"Damn you, halfwit!"
I heard a familiar voice that seemed to be coming from a long way off.
"If you're going catatonic again, have the decency to do it in Haven and save us the trouble of carting your foam-flecked carcass back there. Barring that, get to one side."
Elodin looked away from me, and suddenly everything was bright and clear again. I fought to keep from gasping in a lungful of air. Master Hem stomped down the stairs, shouldering Elodin roughly to one side. When he saw me, he snorted.
"Of course. The quarterwit is here, too. Might I recommend a book for your perusal?
It is a lovely piece of reading titled Hallways, Their Form and Function, a primer for the mentally deficient.
He glowered at me, and when I didn't immediately jump aside, he gave me an unpleasant smile.
Ah, but you're still banned from the archives, aren't you? Should I arrange to present the salient information in a form more suited to your kind? Perhaps a mummer's play or some manner of puppet show.
I stepped to one side, and Hem stormed by, muttering to himself.
Illodin stared daggers into the other master's broad back. Only after Hem turned the corner did Elodin's attention settle back on me.
He sighed. Perhaps it would be better if you pursued your other studies, Relar Quoth. Dahl has a fondness for you, as does Kilvin. You seem to be progressing well with them.
But, sir, I said, trying to keep the dismay out of my voice. You're the one who sponsored my promotion to Relar.
He turned and began climbing the stairs again.
Then you should value my sage advice, shouldn't you?
But if you're teaching other students, why not me?
Because you're too eager to be properly patient, he said flippantly. You're too proud to listen properly, and you're too clever by half. That's the worst of it.
Some masters prefer clever students, I muttered as we emerged into a wide hallway.
Yes, Elodin said. Dahl and Kilvin and Arwill like clever students. Go study with one of them. Both our lives will be considerably easier because of it.
But... Elodin came to an abrupt halt in the middle of the hallway.
Fine, he said. Prove you're worth teaching. Shake my assumptions down to their foundation stones.
He patted at his robes dramatically, as if looking for something lost in a pocket.
Much to my dismay, I find myself without a way to get past this door.
He rapped it with a knuckle.
What do you do in this situation, Relar Quoth?
I smiled, despite my general irritation. He couldn't have picked a challenge more perfectly suited to my talents. I pulled a long, slender piece of spring steel out of a pocket in my cloak, then knelt in front of the door and eyed the keyhole. The lock was substantial, made to last, but while large, heavy locks look impressive. They're actually easier to circumvent if they're well maintained. This one was. It took me the space of 3 slow breaths to trip it with a satisfying katik. I stood up, brushed off my knees, and swung the door inward with a flourish. For his part, Elodin did seem somewhat impressed. His eyebrows went up as the door swung open.
Clever, he said as he walked inside.
I followed on his heels. I'd never really wondered what Elodin's rooms were like, but if I'd guessed, it wouldn't have been anything resembling this. They were huge and lavish, with high ceilings and thick rugs. Old wood paneled the walls, and tall windows let in the early morning light. There were oil paintings and massive pieces of ancient wooden furniture. It was bizarrely ordinary. Elodin moved quickly through the entryway, through a tasteful sitting room, then into the bedroom. Call it a bed chamber, rather. It was huge, with a 4-post bed big as a boat. Elodin threw open a wardrobe and started removing several long, dark robes similar to the one he was wearing.
Here, Elodin shoved robes into my arms until I couldn't hold any more. Some were everyday cotton, but others were fine linen or rich, soft velvet. He lay another 6 robes over his own arm and carried them back into the sitting room.
We passed old bookshelves lined with hundreds of books and a huge, polished desk. One wall was taken up with a large stone fireplace, big enough to roast a pig, though there was currently only a small fire smoldering there, keeping away the early autumn chill. Elodin lifted a crystal decanter off a table and went to stand in front of the fireplace. He dumped the robes he was carrying into my arms so I could barely see over the top of them. Delicately lifting the top off the decanter, he sipped at the contents and raised an eyebrow appreciatively, holding it up to the light. I decided to try again.
Master Elodin, why don't you want to teach me naming?
That's the wrong question, he said, and upended the decanter onto smoldering coals in the fireplace. As the flames licked up hungrily, he took his armload of robes back and fed a velvet one slowly into the fire. It caught quickly, and when it was blazing away, he fed the others onto the fire in quick succession. The result was a great smoldering pile of cloth that sent thick smoke billowing up the chimney. "Try again." I couldn't help but ask the obvious. "Why are you burning your clothes?" "Nope. Not even close to the right question," he said, as he took more robes out of my arms and piled them into the fireplace. Then Elodin grabbed the handle for the flue and pulled it closed with a metallic clank. Great clouds of smoke began to pour into the room. Elodin coughed a bit, then stepped back and looked around in a vaguely satisfied way. I suddenly realized what was going on. "Oh, God," I said. "Whose rooms are these?" Elodin gave a satisfied nod. "Very good. I would also have accepted, 'Why don't you have a key for this room?' or 'What are we doing in here?'" He looked down at me, his eyes serious. "Doors are locked for a reason. People who don't have keys are supposed to stay out, for a reason." He nudged the heap of smoldering cloth with one foot, as if reassuring himself it would stay in the fireplace. "You know you're clever. That's your weakness. You assume you know what you're getting into, but you don't." Elodin turned to look at me, his dark eyes serious. "You think you can trust me to teach you," he said. "You think I will keep you safe. But that is the worst sort of foolishness." "Whose rooms are these?" I repeated numbly. He showed me all his teeth in a sudden grin. "Master Hem's." "Why are you burning all of Master Hem's clothes?" I asked, trying to ignore the fact that the room was rapidly filling with bitter smoke. Elodin looked at me as if I were an idiot. "Because I hate him." He picked up the crystal decanter from the mantel and threw it violently against the back of the fireplace where it shattered. The fire began to burn more vigorously from whatever had been left inside. "The man is an absolute tit. Nobody talks to me like that." Smoke continued to boil into the room. If it weren't for the high ceilings, we'd already be choking on it. Even so, it was becoming hard to breathe as we made our way to the door. Elodin opened it, and smoke rolled out into the hallway. We stood outside the door, staring at each other, while the smoke billowed past. I decided to take a different tack on the problem. "I understand your hesitation, Master Elodin," I said. "Sometimes I don't think things all the way through." "Obviously. And I'll admit there have been times when my actions have been..." I paused, trying to think of something more humble than ill-considered. "Stupid beyond all mortal ken," Elodin said helpfully. My temper flared, burning away my brief attempt at humility. "Well, thank God I'm the only one here that's ever made a bad decision in my life," I said, barely keeping my voice this side of a shout. I looked him hard in the eye. "I've heard stories about you too, you know. They say you toffed things up pretty well yourself back when you were a student here." Elodin's amused expression faded a bit, leaving him looking like he'd swallowed something and it had gotten stuck halfway down. I continued. "If you think I'm reckless, do something about it. Show me the straighter path. Mold my supple young mind." I sucked in a lungful of smoke and began to cough, forcing me to cut my tirade short. "Do something, damn you!" I choked out. "Teach me!" I hadn't really been shouting, but I ended up breathless all the same. My temper faded as quickly as it had flared up, and I worried I'd gone too far. But Elodin just looked at me. "What makes you think I'm not teaching you?" he asked, puzzled. "Aside from the fact that you refuse to learn." Then he turned and walked down the hallway. "I'd get out of here if I were you," he said over his shoulder. "People are going to want to know who's responsible for this, and everyone knows you and Hem don't get on very well." I felt myself break into a panicked sweat. "What?" "I'd wash up before admissions, too," he said. "It won't look good if you show up reeking of smoke." "I live here," Elodin said, pulling a key from his pocket and unlocking a door at the far end of the hallway. "What's your excuse?"
Chapter 9. A Civil Tongue. My hair was still wet when I made my way through a short hallway, then up the stairs onto the stage of an empty theater. As always,
The room was dark except for the huge crescent-shaped table. I moved to the edge of the light and waited politely. The Chancellor motioned me forward, and I walked to the center of the table, reaching up to hand him my tile. Then, I stepped back to stand in the circle of slightly brighter light between the two outthrust horns of the table. The nine masters looked down at me. I'd like to say they looked dramatic, like ravens on a fence or something like that. But while they were all wearing their formal robes, they were too mismatched to look like a collection of anything. What's more, I could see the marks of weariness on them. Only then did it occur to me that as much as the students hated admissions, it was probably no walk in the garden for the masters either.
"Quoth, Aladdin's son," the Chancellor said formally. "Relar."
He made a gesture to the far right-hand horn of the table.
"Master Physiker?"
Arwill peered down at me, his face grandfatherly behind his round spectacles.
"What are the medicinal properties of Menka?" he asked.
"Powerful anesthetic," I said. "Powerful catatoniate. Potential purgative." I hesitated. "It has a whole sack full of complicating secondaries, too. Should I list them all?" Arwill shook his head.
"A patient comes into the medica complaining of pains in their joints and difficulty breathing. Their mouth is dry, and they claim to have a sweet taste in their mouth. They complain of chills, but they are actually sweaty and feverish. What is your diagnosis?"
I drew a breath, then hesitated. "I don't make diagnoses in the medica, Master Arwill. I'd fetch one of your alpha to do it." He smiled at me, eyes crinkling around the edges.
"Correct," he said. "But for the sake of argument, what do you think might be wrong?"
"Is the patient a student?"
Arwill raised an eyebrow. "What does that have to do with the price of butter?"
"If they work in the fishery, it might be smelter's flu," I said. Arwill cocked an eyebrow at me, and I added, "There's all sorts of heavy metal poisoning you can get in the fishery. It's rare around here because the students are well trained, but anyone working with hot bronze can inhale enough fumes to kill themselves if they aren't properly careful." I saw Kilvin nodding along, and I was glad I didn't have to admit the only reason I knew this was that I'd given myself a mild case of it a month ago. Arwill gave a thoughtful humph, then gestured to the other side of the table.
"Master arithmetician?"
Brander sat on the left-hand point of the table.
"Assuming the changer takes 4%, how many pennies can you break from a talent?"
He asked the question without looking up from the papers in front of him.
"What type of penny, Master Brander?"
He looked up, frowning.
"We're still in the Commonwealth, if I remember correctly."
I juggled numbers in my head, working from the figures in the books he'd set aside in the archives. They weren't the true exchange rates you would get from a moneylender. They were the official exchange rates governments and financiers used so they had common ground for lying to each other.
"In iron pennies, 350, I said, then added, "One and a half."
Brander looked down at the papers before I'd even finished speaking.
"Your compass reads gold at 220 points, platinum at 112 points, and cobalt at 32 points. Where are you?"
I was boggled by the question. Orienting by trifoil required detailed maps and painstaking triangulation. It was usually only practiced by sea captains and cartographers, and they used detailed charts to make their calculations. I'd only ever laid eyes on a trifoil compass twice in my life. Either this was a question listed in one of the books Brander had set aside for study, or it was deliberately designed to spike my wheel. Given that Brander and Hem were friends, I guessed it was the latter. I closed my eyes, brought up a map of the civilized world in my head, and took my best guess.
"Tarbian?" I said. "Maybe somewhere in Yil?"
I opened my eyes. "Honestly, I have no idea." Brander made a mark on a piece of paper.
"Master Namer,"
he said without looking up. Elodin gave me a wicked, knowing grin, and I was suddenly struck with the fear that he might reveal my part of what we had done in Hem's rooms earlier that morning. Instead, he held up three fingers dramatically.
You have 3 spades in your hand, he said, and there have been 5 spades played. He steepled his fingers and looked at me seriously. How many spades is that?
8 spades, I said. The other masters stirred slightly in their seats. Arwill sighed, Kilvin slouched, Hem and Brandur went too far as to roll their eyes at each other. Altogether, they gave the impression of long-suffering exasperation.
Elodin scowled at them.
What?
He demanded, his voice going hard around the edges.
You want me to take this song and dance more seriously? You want me to ask him questions only a namer can answer?
The other master stilled at this, looking uncomfortable and refusing to meet his eye. Hem was the exception and glared openly.
Fine, Elodin said, turning back to me. His eyes were dark, and his voice had a strange resonance to it. It wasn't loud, but when he spoke, it seemed to fill the entire hall. It left no space left over for any other sound.
Where does the moon go? Elodin asked grimly. When it is no longer in our sky.
The room seemed unnaturally quiet when he stopped speaking, as if his voice had left a hole in the world. I waited to see if there was more to the question.
I haven't the slightest, I admitted.
After Elodin's voice, my own seemed rather thin and insubstantial. Elodin shrugged, then gestured graciously across the table.
Master sympathist?
Elxadal was the only one who really looked comfortable in his formal robes. As always, his dark beard and lean face made me think of the evil magician in so many bad Aturin plays. He gave me a bit of a sympathetic look.
How about the binding for linear galvanic attraction? He said in an offhand way.
I rattled it off easily.
He nodded. What's the distance of insurmountable decay for iron?
5.5 miles, I said, giving the textbook answer despite the fact that I had some quibbles with the term insurmountable. While it was true that moving any significant amount of energy more than 6 miles was statistically impossible, you could still use sympathy to douse over much greater distances.
Once an ounce of water is boiling, how much heat will it take to boil it completely away?
I dragged up what I could remember from the vaporization tables I'd worked with in the fishery. 180 thoms, I said, with more assurance than I actually felt.
Good enough for me, Dahl said. Master Alchemist?
Mandrag waved a mottled hand dismissively.
I'll pass. He's good with questions about spades,
Elodin suggested.
Mandrag frowned at Elodin. Master Archivist.
Lauren stared down at me, his long face impassive.
What are the rules of the archives?
I flushed at this and looked down.
Move quietly, I said. Respect the books, obey the scribes, no water, no food.
I swallowed.
No fire.
Lauren nodded. Nothing in his tone or demeanor indicated any sort of disapproval, but that just made it worse. His eyes moved across the table.
Master Artificer?
I cursed inwardly. Over the last span, I'd read all 6 books Master Lauren had set aside for R'hllar to study from. Feltimi Rice's Fall of Empire alone took me 10 hours. I wanted few things more than access to the archives, and I desperately hoped to impress Master Lauren by answering whatever question he could think to ask. But there was no help for it. I turned to face Kilvin.
Galvanic throughput of copper!
The great bear-like master rumbled through his beard. I gave it to 5 places. I'd had to use it while making calculations for the deck lamps.
Conductive coefficient of gallium.
I needed to know that to dope the emitters for the lamps. Was Kilvin lobbing me easy questions? I gave the answer.
Good,
Kilvin said.
Master rhetorician.
I drew a deep breath as I turned to look at Hem. I had gone so far as to read 3 of his books, though I have a sharp loathing for rhetoric and pointless philosophy. Still, I could tamp down my distaste for 2 minutes' time and play the part of a good, humble student. I am one of the Rue. I could act the part. Hem scowled at me, his round face like an angry moon.
"Did you set fire to my rooms, you little ravel bastard?"
The raw nature of the question caught me entirely off my guard. I was ready for impossibly hard questions, or trick questions, or questions he could twist to make any answer I gave seem wrong. But this sudden accusation caught me utterly wrong-footed. Ravel is a term I particularly despise. A welter of emotion rolled through me and brought the sudden taste of plum to my mouth. While part of me was still considering the most gracious way to respond, I found I was already speaking. "I didn't set fire to your rooms," I said honestly, "but I wish I had. And I wish you'd been in there when it started, sleeping soundly." Hem's expression turned from scowling to astonished.
"Rela Quoth!"
the Chancellor snapped. "You will keep a civil tongue in your head, or I will bring you up on charges of conduct unbecoming myself." The taste of plum disappeared as quickly as it had come, leaving me feeling slightly dizzy and sweating with fear and embarrassment. "My apologies, Chancellor," I said quickly, looking down at my feet. "I spoke in anger. Ravel is a term my people find particularly offensive. Its use makes light of the systematic slaughter of thousands of Rue." A curious line appeared between the Chancellor's eyebrows.
"I'll admit I don't know that particular etymology," he mused. "I guess I'll make that my question." "Hold off!" Hem interrupted. "I'm not finished."
"You are finished," the Chancellor said, his voice hard and firm. "You're as bad as the boy, Jason, and with less excuse. You've shown you can't conduct yourself in a professional manner, so stint thy clep and consider yourself lucky I don't call for an official censure."
Hem went white with anger, but he held his tongue.
The Chancellor turned to look at me.
"Master Linguist," he announced himself formally. "Rela Quoth, what is the etymology of the word ravel?"
"It comes from the purges instigated by Emperor Alcyon," I said. "He issued a proclamation saying any of the traveling rabble on the roads were subject to fines, imprisonment, or transportation without trial." The term became shortened to ravel through metaplasmic enclitization. He raised an eyebrow at that.
"Did it now?"
I nodded. "Though I also expect there is a connection to the term ravel end, referring to the ragged appearance of performing troops that are out at the heels." The Chancellor nodded formally.
"Thank you, Rela Quoth. Take a seat while we confer."
Chapter 10. Being Treasured. My tuition was set at 9 talents and 5. Better than the 10 talents Manette had predicted, but more than I had in my purse. I had until tomorrow noon to settle up with the bursar, or I would be forced to miss an entire term. Having to postpone my studies wouldn't have been a tragedy, but only students are allowed access to university resources such as the equipment in the artificery. That meant if I couldn't pay my tuition, I would be barred from my work in Kilvin's shop, the only job where I could hope to earn enough money for my tuition. I stopped at the stocks, and Jackson smiled as I approached the open window.
"Just sold your lamps this morning," he said. "We squeezed them for a little extra because they were the last ones left."
He leafed through the ledger until he found the appropriate page. "Your 60% comes out to 4 talents and 8 jots. After the materials and piecework you used," he ran his finger down a page, "you're left with 2 talents, 3 jots, and 8 drabs. Jackson made a note in the ledger, then wrote me a receipt. I folded the paper carefully and tucked it into my purse. It didn't have the satisfying weight of coins, but it brought my total up to more than 6 talents. So much money, but still not enough. If I hadn't lost my temper with Hem, my tuition might have been low enough. I could have studied more, or earned more money if I hadn't been forced to hide in my room for almost 2 whole days, weeping and raging with a taste of plum in my mouth. A thought occurred to me. "I should start something new, I guess," I said casually. "I'll need a small crucible,
3 ounces of tin, 2 ounces of bronze, 4 ounces of silver, a spool of fine gold wire, a copper... Hold on a second, Jackson interrupted me. He ran a finger back along my name in the ledger. I don't have you authorized for gold or silver. He looked up at me. Is that a mistake? I hesitated, not wanting to lie. I didn't know you needed authorization, I said. Jackson gave me a knowing grin. You're not the first one to try something like that, he said. Rough tuition? I nodded. He grimaced sympathetically. Sorry. Kilvin knows stocks could turn into a moneylender's stall if he isn't careful. He closed the ledger. You'll have to hit the pawn shop like everyone else. I held up my hands, showing him the fronts and backs to make a point of my lack of jewelry. Jackson winced. That's rough. I know a decent moneylender on Silver Court only charges 10% a month. It's still like having your teeth pulled, but better than most. I nodded and sighed. Silver Court was where the guild moneylenders had their shops. They wouldn't give me the time of day. It's certainly better than I've gotten in the past, I said. I thought things over while I walked to Imre, the familiar weight of my loot resting on one shoulder. I was in a tight spot, but not a terrible one. No guild moneylender would lend money to an orphan Adima Rue with no collateral, but I could borrow the money from Davy. Still, I wish it hadn't come to that. Not only was her rate of interest extortionate, but I worried what favors she might require of me if I ever defaulted my loan. I doubted they would be small, or easy, or entirely legal. Such were the turnings of my thoughts as I made my way over Stonebridge. I stopped by an apothecary, then made my way to the Gray Man. Opening the door, I saw the Gray Man was a boarding house. There was no common room where people could gather and drink. Instead, there was a small, richly appointed parlor, complete with a well-dressed porter who eyed me with an air of disapproval, if not outright distaste.
"Can I help you, young sir?"
he asked as I came in the door. "I'm calling on a young lady," I said, "by the name of Danael." He nodded.
"I shall go and see if she's in."
"Don't trouble yourself," I said, moving toward the stairs. "She's expecting me." The man moved to block my way.
"I'm afraid that isn't possible," he said. "But I will be glad to see if the lady is in."
He held out his hand. I looked at it.
"Your calling card?" he asked. "That I might present it to the young lady."
"How can you give her my card if you aren't sure she's in?" I asked. The porter gave me the smile again. It was gracious, polite, and so sharply unpleasant that I took special note of it, fixing it in my memory. A smile like that is a work of art. As someone who grew up on the stage, I could appreciate it on several levels. A smile like that is like a knife in certain social settings, and I might have need of it someday.
"Ah," the porter said. "The lady is in," he said with a certain emphasis. "But that does not necessarily mean she is in for you."
"You can tell her Quoth has come calling," I said, more amused than offended. "I'll wait." I didn't have to wait long. The porter came down the stairs wearing an irritated expression, as if he'd been looking forward to throwing me out.
"This way," he said.
I followed him upstairs. He opened a door, and I swept past him with what I hoped was an irritating amount of dismissive aplomb. It was a sitting room with wide windows that let in the late afternoon sun, large enough to seem spacious despite the scattered chairs and couches. A hammer dulcimer sat against the far wall, and one corner of the room was entirely occupied by a massive Modegan great harp. Denna stood in the center of the room wearing a green velvet dress. Her hair was arranged to display her elegant neck to good effect, revealing the emerald teardrop earrings and matching necklace at her throat. She was talking to a young man who was... the best word I can think of is pretty. He had a sweet, clean-shaven face with wide, dark eyes. He had the look of a young noble who had been down on his luck too long for it to be a temporary thing. His clothing was fine but rumpled. His dark hair was cut in a style obviously meant to be curled, but it hadn't been